Directors to avoid.
Never.
Obnoxious directors to avoid.
Oh, but you're not on that list.
Not yet. Wait till the end of the interview. Wait till the end of the interview.
I already told them you're too nice. So.
Oh, okay. I've got to get my obnoxious up going.
Well, speaking of obnoxious.
How are you this morning?
In the movie, obviously there's some obnoxious people.
Right.
But at the end, you kind of feel speechless because you're like, wow, the state of humanity.
Right.
You know, I mean, what was it like directing the actors in that aspect?
I mean, you know, great because there was such a great bunch of actors. You know, I was thinking about it earlier that, you know, the key thing with the cast was to try and make sure even the characters who are playing what you'd look at as being, you know, being the bad guys, like the Tony Goldwyns and John Gallagher, mm-hmm. John McGinley and those guys. The key thing is making those guys feel like we understand why they're doing it. You know, not to play them as cartoons, but to play them very serious, very kind of, you know, find the humanity in the decisions that everyone's making, so it doesn't feel like a cartoon. And then we're judging someone too harshly, because the whole question is, what would you do in that situation? How would you react? Actually, I was just talking to someone in the elevator who saw it the other day, and she said she saw it, and she immediately was thinking, what would I have done in that scenario? And that's what is good for people to think about. It's a, you know, that's one of the things that you come out of the movie with thinking, how would you be a John McGinley? Would you be Danny, or who would you be in the movie?
Right.
I would definitely be the one who hides in the elevator and just kind of waits till the end.
Kind of to that point, a lot of people are saying that it's The Office meets Battle Royale, whatnot.
Right.
But I look at it more like the trolley problem
mm-hmm.
meets Lord of the Flies.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And to your point, what you were saying is, what would you do? Which leads me to my question: What would you do? Would you save this chunk of people that you know are guaranteed to be saved,
mm-hmm.
at least up until that point in the plot?
Yeah.
You didn't know anybody else was going to die. Or do you go ahead and just start killing off the prerequisite amount?
Look, I think it's always hard. Like, you know, when it's always hard. I don't think anyone ever knows what they're doing in any situation. I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to be John Gallagher, because John Gallagher is kind of the moral center we'd all like to have, because he you know, and in one sense, the movie is a discussion about moral choices. It's saying, is it right just because the corporation is saying to do something, we do it? So the film, in one sense, becomes a discussion about the kind of evil of corporate ideology,
mm-hmm.
which forces people to just accept the bottom line above all other considerations, which is really the monster in the movie. So for me, the monster is, you know, the corporate ideology. What would I do? In reality, what would I do? Probably run and scream and call for my mummy. what would I like to do? I'd like to do what John Gallagher does, which is basically try to convince people that those values are wrong. You know, those values are evil.
Since this is scripted by James Gunn, who's a fellow filmmaker, did he pretty much let you run with it and make any changes you see fit, or do you pretty much try to get or capture what James Gunn envisioned?
I mean, it was an amazing script, and James is a very clear writer, so the script had, you know, fantastically well-written characters, good arcs, that kind of stuff. When I pitched for the movie, I made a very comprehensive visual you know, presentation, about a 20-page book of images showing how I'd do each scene. And also, I wrote, like, my thesis of the movie, which is where I said, this is what I think the movie is about, this is what it should be, this is how it should feel, this is how it should be designed. And then once they kind of saw that, you know, I presented that to he and Peter Safran, they were like, you know, they loved my approach to it. And I think that, you know, I think they, James in particular, responded to my working with actors in the past, because I think he felt, which I felt, that for this movie to be effective, you had to believe the performances and you had to believe the reality of what was going on, because it's so crazy and wacky and silly as an idea. If you don't buy into each moment, then the movie's not going to work. And it could very easily be very silly. I mean, it's crazy as it is, but it could be, you know, there's a level where it could jump over the edge. Mm-hmm. I think.
You know, Greg, I'm curious about working with Julia Wong, her editor, and the editing process here. So it's striking right now because she edited Belko. Also, The Last Word with Shirley MacLaine, which is also out now.
Right.
Two totally different looks, styles, thematics.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this one, how difficult was the editing process given the amount of madness and mayhem?
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, for a start, Julia is a great editor. I loved her. She's done a lot of action movies. She's done a lot of, you know, emotional drama. You know, she's great. I mean, she was a great collaborator. I mean, you know, we had storyboarded the whole movie. So basically, every movie I do, I storyboard every single frame. So I've got that book. And so as I'm shooting, I'm sending the storyboards and saying, here's my first thought about how it should go, and now you just go for it, and you see if what we've got makes sense with that. So when I came back to the from Columbia to LA, because we were cutting in Burbank, she had assemblies of things, and then, you know, we just got into it. But it was, it's a very intense action film. So the editing is, it was a big process. It was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm saying is it was really hard.
How far did you deviate? Did the final edit deviate from what you had on your storyboards?
Not much. It's pretty specific. Like, it's, in some cases, I actually looked at my original pitch document again the other day, and it's kind of scary how there are frames that, it's weird, because when you read a, you know, for me, when I read a script, and I'll have certain images that just become clear, and then the whole job of making the movie is basically saying, can I maintain that to the end? Can I get that to the screen so when you guys see it, you see that thing that I first saw that, you know, last year? And, you know, thankfully we have been able to basically, you look at the movie now and I go, oh, there's that, we got that idea across, we got that image, or the thing that you really fell in love with. Like, for me, one of the key images from the movie is the image of Andrea and John in front of the Belko sign hugging. Because I thought it was so interesting to have this kind of human romance against this horror. And even though it's kind of, it's kind of a weird counterpoint, to see that kind of humanity and that kind of beauty of that moment, you know, in that context, I thought was really moving and interesting.
This film seems to be part of a kind of a delicious subgenre of horror, you know, the deadly game kind of subgenre. Battle Royale's obviously on the poster, but you think even Back to the Running Man, you know, and films like that. I'm wondering if when you were approaching this and when you were sort of making this document about how you would direct the film, those kind of films were in your head and you were kind of aware of that trope.
I was aware of the trope, but I'm a fan of those movies. I think my directorial approach to it was more about, what was clear to me in the script and what was clear about, you know, how I thought it would make it work was the notion of the counterpoint. And what I mean by that is basically, on the one hand, having something that is extremely realistic and believable in order to kind of entertain this crazy idea, because it's a ludicrous concept. But in order to make it play, in order to make the audience sit through it and kind of go with it and kind of believe it, you've got to have this extreme realism. And that comes down to a performance style that's all about spontaneous kind of feeling performances. So you feel like you're watching things, for the first time and, you know, very believable.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, you know, finding a counterpoint between extreme, normality and extreme insanity. Because there's a craziness in the film that I wanted to really embrace. And I was looking at, really, really inspired by Wolf of Wall Street, because, you know, there you have a 70-year-old filmmaker who's just going completely batshit with his stuff. And the same year you had George Miller, who's also 70 years old, making Mad Max Fury Road. You're going, I'm half these guys' age, and they're fucking going crazy, so what am I doing? So I was watching those movies when I was preparing it in Columbia going, okay, this is, you know, gloves are off, let's go bananas here. And some people may have thought we could have gone further, but you know, that was what I was sort of being inspired by. And I mean, visually, I was looking at Goodfellas, because I was very conscious of trying to move the camera more and trying to kind of look at violence in an interesting way, to make sure that when you had moments of violence, it was done in an artistic way and an interesting way, so that it was always entertaining. And it can also, there's ways you can do violence where it's actually quite funny. And I feel like the film is very funny and very, there's a cartoon element to it, which I really enjoy as well. Cool. Which I hope you guys thought it was funny as well. So I'm just sick. You're looking at me like...
Well, speaking of that, was that aimed at the blood squirt? It almost seemed kind of like a comic book. Type.
Yes.
I mean, was that the goal?
This is a conversation we're having in pre-production as well. There's a lot of conversation about saying, what does it look like when a head explodes?
Mm-hmm.
And we had the prosthetic guys do tests, and it quickly became apparent that it's quite fun. It's quite, I mean, it's terrible, but it's funny.
People were laughing.
It's funny. I mean, there's something that, for me, there's a level where violence becomes so intense that it becomes hilarious. Like, I found the new Evil Dead movie, I found that quite funny. I don't know what it's supposed to be, but I found it kind of hilarious. There's a point where violence just becomes hilarious. And if you think about, Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, and all those cartoons we all grew up with, they're full of people whacking and hitting and things. They don't have blood, but they have everything but. So I think visually, there's a lot of visual comedy to be gotten from violence.
Was
she
shooting in Colombia part of the original story?
Yeah, the movie, the script was always set in a South American city, and then we, when I came onto the film, it was set up to be shot in Bogota, and I had actually, I was familiar with the area because I was talking to some producers there about another project, and this film came straight ahead. And actually, since this movie, I've actually shot another movie in Colombia, so I've shot two movies in a row in Colombia. But it was great. It was great to shoot there. Great.
What was the shoot like? Was it a bit Apocalypse Now?
It was, yes, it was a bit Apocalypse Now. It was basically, quite a low-budget film, incredibly huge cast, not much prep time, and, 6 or 7 weeks, I can't quite remember, blocked it out. An insanely short amount of time to shoot it. So from a directorial point of view, like an amazing challenge. And, all that comes, to pull that off, it really comes down to preparation. So, I storyboard everything I do. Shoot diagrams for every single day, every setup. And when you're doing 4 or 5 scenes a day with guns, with fire, with blood, with stuff, it can get crazy. And towards the end, we had... it was towards the end of the shoot where we were doing consistently 16, 17-hour days. The crew were dropping like flies. There was like almost a rebellion on the set. We had... It was a challenge because it's a big movie and you're trying to do a big movie... for not much money. In Australia, we don't have a big budget film industry. So for me, it was a kind of beefed up challenge, but it was still what I'm used to.
With the time constraints on the shooting, you have a really great ensemble of comedians and
right.
people that are part of the cast. So did it leave any room for improv, or was it mostly stuff that stuck on the script?
We kind of stuck to script, but there's certainly, because they're such great actors and they inhabit their characters so fully, there's lots of moments in the film where they just invented something. Either it's a movement or a physical action or a word or something that made a scene come alive. The thing is, you can't make a movie like this unless you have all the actors totally 100% giving their all. If we had a difficult actor who would spend half an hour talking about what's my motivation, we wouldn't have shot the day. We'd still be there right now. We'd still be there. But all the actors were super smart, super intelligent, prepared and came to set wanting to do good work. And also we had a very good time. Even though it was stressful and intense, we had an amazingly good time. Crazy good time. Because they're such great people. And everyone sort of gelled.
We get to hang out with some of the talent on Valentine's Day.
Right.
And they told us that this was a working office building. Can you tell us
right.
the difficulties to deal with people that going on their 9 to 5 and here you are blowing people
yes.
up?
We had most of the movie is shot on. We found an office building that had 3 floors that were empty, and it was a working building. So we had to basically, we're all in hotels in downtown Bogota. We'd all get into our vans. We'd go there in pre-production. We had to finish the floors and fit them out, and then basically we had to go in there every day. So we'd go through the buildings, all through our security, and we'd all take all our stuff up to the floors, pass all these people standing with their coffees going, what the hell's going on floor 6? And then we'd be up there running and screaming and shooting and stuff all day. And we had security guards either side, who just didn't know, hadn't seen much filmmaking, what the hell is going on? It was some very unusual looks from the security guys. And then we'd walk out at the end of the day, we'd sort of stagger out of there after shooting for hours and hours at the end of the night. Some days I'd walk out and I was covered in blood. I wouldn't know because I was so into it, getting shots and stuff. And I was, some of the, the John McGinley head thing, I was personally doing the axing to the face. So I would walk out that day covered with blood and be like, bye. And they're like, this is really weird.
Well, Cartel Nation, so they're probably used to it.
Yeah, they thought, it's probably, they thought, someone from Medellin's probably just taking out a couple of... They're just closing some deals on the third floor. This is usual.
I'm curious about the music.
Right.
Tyler does all of the music for all of James's films.
Right.
He's also got John Wick out there now.
Yeah.
But the music is so key. We get a lot of the humor from the contrast
right.
of the music, using a lot of Stravinsky and then some operatic pieces,
right.
contrasting, the mayhem.
Right, yeah.
What kind of discussions did you have with Tyler about the incorporation of music?
Yeah.
And how much of input did James have as a producer
right.
because of his relationship with Tyler?
Right. One of the good things about James being a producer in the film was he said, do you like Tyler Bates? And I'm like, I love Tyler Bates. Can we get him? And Tyler, read the script, loved it. We talked and we kind of hit a tone pretty early. I said, look, for me, the movie's about counterpoint. And that means that basically, and that's a musical thing as well, where basically you have to allow the audience to get out of the horror by having a musical language that reminds you that it's ironic, it's funny, it's not serious, even though it's kind of intense, you've got to get out of it occasionally. And the very first call with James and Peter, I said, look, we have to find a way to... and I sort of described... I basically said, look, if you imagine Devo, Beautiful World by Devo, while you're looking at the trailer for this movie, that to me is the insanity of what the movie is. Because it's a pop song that seems to be about something, but it's really about something else. And if you counterpoint that with the image of the extreme kind of horror, you get this really fantastic kind of sense of, you know, creepiness. There's a creepy sense to that kind of counterpoint. Tyler loved that idea. And then basically, when we cut the film, I just, tend to kind of get bits and pieces of music from everyone and just kind of put things together to talk about the tone and the kind of feel. And we were looking at we wanted to kind of keep the audience in the world of the film, in the kind of emotional world of the film, and only break it very occasionally, and only then to kind of jump out to a comedic thing, like the elevator music I thought was very funny and ironic. And I actually quite like elevator music just generally, but then also just the pop songs. I always thought it would be great to have the idea that there's a Colombian radio station that's playing, that they're always, it's playing all over the building. So as it's all going down, you hear hearing these covers of these pop songs,
right,
to give the counterpoint to what's going on. So I thought that was a really effective way to kind of keep the audience in the film, but at the same time remind them that they can laugh and, and enjoy it.
Speaking of laughing, what's the story behind the corn toy thing?
The corn cut.
Was that in the script, or did you guys like pick it up? Like,
no, it's totally in the script. Like, it's totally in the script. And that was something that. It was there for it's literally there, and it took some work to get it to look just right. It's a ridiculous looking thing. I always thought it should be like just the poster, like just that with a bit of blood over it. But no, and it's a very funny prop, And then look, when you're designing a movie, every single element is crucial to design. You're designing the colors of the floor, so we created an entire color scheme to create a differentiation between the seventh floor, fifth, fourth, the basement, so that as you're going through the film, you feel like you're going on a journey visually. Even if you don't recognize the time, subconsciously you're getting the different personalities of the different floors and the different characters and that kind of stuff.
Cool.
So at the end, it suggests that this kind of thing is also happening in other buildings, other offices, other parts of the world. So will there be a spin-off, a movie, sequel about that? I can imagine this being like a Cube franchise. I don't know if you know.
Right, I do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So is there a plan like that? And will you be helming it if there's...
Saw.
If it's open to it?
Look, I mean, there are only sequels to successful movies. So after the movie opens, we'll see whether it's a hit movie or not. It certainly lends itself to being an idea that can be extrapolated into further movies. But at the moment, there's no plans to do that. I hope there is.
You know if they're going to release an actual soundtrack? Because I really love the soundtrack.
The soundtrack is being released, yeah. So Lakeshore are releasing the score. I think it's coming up very soon. I saw... it's coming up really soon. And it's by Lakeshore Records. And it's a great score.
Oh,
it's a beautiful score. I love... I mean, I just love what Tyler did in the movie. I think his score is phenomenal for the film.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to buy it, so at least there'll be two sales.
Two sales. Anybody else?
Because it's true, that one scene where the aria was playing.
Right.
I was like...
Yeah.
I was into the aria, but... This
right, right. Well, that again speaks to, some of my favorite directors are Scorsese is one of my favorite directors. Stanley Kubrick also used music and counterpointing music. I find a lot of interesting filmmakers, there's always an interesting use of music in their movies because, when you play a particular piece of music over a particular bit of drama, the more extreme the difference between the two things, the greater the impact will be. So when you're looking at a moment of real horror like that, of people being herded together to get killed, and you play this extreme, beautiful, gorgeous, lilting piece of vibrating music, it makes it even more tragic and more sad because it forces you to think about the humanity of what's going on. And also, I used to work in opera, so I always love to chuck opera in wherever I can because I think I love operatic music.
Now, with all of these fabulous manners of death being shown on screen, is there one that, had you been one of those people that had to be eliminated, Do you have a preferred manner of how you would have liked to have been eliminated?
I think I'd like to go how Danny goes. It's like a bullet in the head. I like quick. I mean, just a quick like door.
Okay.
I would. My worst one would be to John McGinley.
Yeah, well, you did that.
So. I physically did it, but I would not like to be the recipient of that particular. An angry Adria Arjona is something you do not want to face. Yeah, she's a badass.
So what is her name? Melanie Diaz's character?
Yeah.
So you think she's going to be like the red herring, and then you...
Right.
Yeah.
Too much?
I was sort of mad, but was that the point? I mean, that you wanted to destroy the expectation?
I think that was a very extremely entertaining part of the script was you know, taking in expectations and reversing expectations. Mm. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I mean, I think great, you know, we all see a lot of movies and we all see a lot of genre films. Yeah. So, you know, you've got to kind of reverse things and play with things and play with it to make it entertaining and fun. I think that's what, when I first read the script, what I loved about it, I had no idea where it was going. When I got to that, I'm like, what? What the hell? she can't die? I think it's fun for an audience. You know, and I just read like an audience. I'm just like, you know, and I think the thing is, as a director, try and find things where you can genuinely have a chance to surprise the audience. Because if you're surprised, then the audience is going to be surprised about it as well.
Well, it's funny how things work that way. At first you're mad, but then you're like, yeah, but then if it would have played out the way we thought it would, maybe we would have been mad.
Right.
So,
yeah. It's interesting.
How viewers work, viewership, right?
Right, that's right. No, I think it's interesting. And a lot of people, when we're finishing the film and testing, I think there was a lot of people who were just like, do we really want to kill Danny? Like, it was just like this whole save Danny thing going on, like, keep her alive, you know. But no, it was just too much fun to see Tony Goldwyn shoot her.
Yeah, her character is pretty gangster, doing that balancing heels.
Yes, I know. I watched it the other day. I'm thinking, God, why didn't you take the heels off? Because it's like, you look at, I'm sure the audience is going, take the heels off. But she's just like, yeah.
No, because if she had taken the heels off, she would have had to drop them, and then whoever was in the elevator below would have heard the heels.
Mm-hmm. Or they would have looked up and got a heel in the eyeball. Up. Yeah. That's another kill we could have
had. Right.
But that would have had to be perfect going through the little vent.
The little vent.
That would have been the tough one.
Right. That was tricky.
You do what you gotta do for those Christian Louboutins, you know?
Exactly, right?
Well, you know they weren't Louboutins because the songs weren't red.
Right.
So.
Yeah, they weren't red bottoms.
Those weren't her work shoes.
And we wouldn't have had the good shot of them dropping through the elevator, which is kind of, I find that quite funny. The first thing you see is these shoes dropping in the frame, and it's kind of hilarious.
I really like, you didn't go gratuitous with nudity, like when he sees the, when Tony sees the girl that, you know, he's been eyeballing.
Right.
Yeah, I know what you want.
Right.
I really like that you didn't go super gratuitous. I'm like, oh, well, of course. No,
right.
It was the complete opposite. Just
I know. That scene, I think, is like, to me, that was one of the scenes that you think, God, is this movie just too much? I mean, it's berserk, but it's fun though, because it's fun because it's expectations. You think, what's going to happen in this moment? And Tony just like coldly going, you know, I can't waste a bullet. It's such a it shows that he's gone back into warrior mode.
Yeah. Well, it goes to your point about instincts, right?
Right.
And your first, what you're compelled to do when you're given that choice, instead of going on to his sexual instincts,
right,
as it were, he just goes primal and survival, and he goes
right. Yeah, and literally uses something he would have used as, you know, I mean, there's a suggestion. Well, they say in the film that McGinley and he were basically in special forces.
Right.
And actually, what we did actually have a shot. We actually photographed both of them in special forces outfits, and we had a shot on his desk when he sits down to have his coffee. There was a shot of that thing, but it was just like a little bit confusing because it's hard to read in 2 seconds what it is.
Yeah.
But what we're saying, and it was in the script, that we cut to a shot of him as special forces back wherever they were. But I think you get the idea in the film. You know these guys have got training in there.
And of course, McGinley's character is the one that is seriously suffering from PTSD.
Yeah. It's like, I think the thing is, you know, in those kind of situations, there's always someone who's just been waiting their whole life for that situation to happen. And so, you know, everyone else is dreading. He's like, great, I'm back. I mean, he goes straight into it. He's like, awesome. We get to kill people again? Great.
Because that's all he wants to do.
That's right. He's right into it. He's no, you know, within 20 seconds of the second announcement, he's in there fighting weapons and he's ready to go.
I really like when he was on that Rico Suave thing, though. He goes, "Why are you playing games, girl?" You know what I mean?
Right,
like, like, dude.
It's a creepy scene. Yeah. It's a creepy scene. It kind of sort of sets up that notion that you see the dynamic. What's fun is seeing the dynamics before it becomes, you know, completely survival mode. And then they then play out in the survival mode in a really interesting way. Because then you see him escalate his relationship with her, and it's like, oh, right. You know, without the kind of veneer of civilization, that relationship becomes very nasty very quickly.
Yeah. Dangerous for sure.
Very dangerous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
Good to meet you all.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks for coming.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks. See you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
See you.
And yes, again.
Thanks.